In the late 90s, with the success of using mesh for hernia repair, for abdominal wall hernia repair, a number of gynecologists thought, well, if mesh is successful in sorting out the hernia and prolapse itself, and perhaps the weakness in the bladder neck is also a type of hernia, why don't we use mesh to treat these conditions? Time went by and we started to see all the complications coming out. And in Scotland, the problem became very obvious at a relatively earlier stage. And that's why the government intervened very quickly in 2014 and decided to suspend all procedures.
Hi, and welcome back to the Business of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Tara Humphrey. I run an award-winning healthcare consultancy specialising in supporting primary care networks. I'm a facilitator. I am a mum of three. I have an MBA, and I would class myself as a bit of an adventurer. And I absolutely love all things business, all things leadership, all things management. So I created this podcast for clinical and non-clinical colleagues working in the field of health and care, and for those of you looking to develop your leadership skills. Every week we release an episode which focuses on the hard and soft skills required to lead in this increasingly complex environment as we move to delivering more integrated care. So let's jump into this week's episode. Hey, Will, thank you so much for joining me today on the Business of Healthcare podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very good, Tara. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. So sometimes I like to share with my audience how we got connected. So in this instance, I met your wife at a family diabetes event, and she said, oh my gosh, you need to speak to my husband.
You must have got your enthusiasm about what you do in healthcare. So, yeah.
So we could talk about a lot of things, but specifically, I wanted to further understand, and I think our audience will be really interested in the mesh scandal and your role in it. But if you could start actually with sharing a little bit about who you are and what you do.
So I'm a consultant gynecologist. I subspecialize in urogynecology, and this is the area in gynecology that deals with problems from childbirth mainly, which is urinary incontinence and pelvic organ prolapse. So in very simple terms, this is the loss of bladder control and escape of urine drops when someone coughs, sneezes, does physical activities, and that is usually because of damage to the pelvic floor muscle from childbirth. And also, that is the same reason why some women will develop prolapse, so the bladder can come down further because of the loss of support from damage from childbirth to the muscles and to the ligaments as well that supports these organs.
Okay, so where shall we start?
Let me start this morning. Actually, they're all hot in the news because it's on BBC Breakfast this morning, all about the prolapse and the childbirth damage. And it's amazing how the BBC raises awareness about this matter. And there's a large number of women actually who share their own story. It's like a silent epidemic.
Where did it start? Because I thought naively, and obviously not close to it, I thought it was kind of done now.
You mean the mesh issue?
Yeah.
Yes. So basically, to repair the damage from the childbirth, historically, or this is what we've always done it, pelvic floor exercises can prevent the issue. Pelvic floor exercises can treat the damage. And in most women, it is successful. And most women, the exercises repair the damage. But some of them will require surgery. And the standard way of surgical repair is by using the woman's own tissues. What we call a native tissue repair. We don't bring anything from outside. It's just your own tissues, holding them together with some sutures that dissolve spontaneously. In the late 90s, with the success of using mesh for hernia repair, for abdominal wall hernia repair, a number of gynecologists thought, well, if mesh is successful in sorting out the hernia and prolapse itself, and perhaps the weakness in the bladder neck is also a type of hernia, why don't we use mesh to treat these conditions? So, and this is how the use of mesh devices was introduced in the late 90s. It became the most commonly performed procedure very, very quickly, with, I would say, not a highly robust evidence, to be honest, particularly on long-term outcome. And by 2001, 2002, it became the most commonly performed procedure in the UK and probably in most of the Western countries as well. Time went by and we started to see all the complications coming out. And in Scotland, the problem became very obvious at a relatively earlier stage. And that's why the government intervened very quickly in 2014. It was June 2014, actually, so we're coming up to 10 years ago, and decided to suspend all procedures. But the vast majority of clinicians and surgeons thought that is a very good procedure and should not be suspended. So some of them continued doing these procedures, even though it was suspended by government until the firm suspension came 4 years later.
Did you continue to use it once there was a suspension?
No, I did not use any of the mesh devices or implant any mesh devices after the suspension. In fact, I stopped the majority of the mesh devices I was using well before the suspension. I continued using only one device, which was a traditional classic one that has most of the evidence on it at the time. But the number of women were choosing this option continued to reduce significantly even before the suspension. And I think this comes to counseling, especially when they understand there are risks that are not associated with the mesh complication. So if you have an operation using your own tissues without mesh device, then you don't get the mesh complications.
Okay, what were the complaints? What were they experiencing a few years down the line?
Most of the complaints were around chronic pain. And because devices are implanted in the pelvis, this pain is in the lower abdomen. It's in the groin, it's deep in the pelvis, it's in the vagina. And because it's in the lower abdomen and the groin, it affects the movement of the hip and movement of the leg. So that's why in women where chronic pain was significant enough, it did affect their mobility. And that's why if you Google mesh complications or government action or something like this, you will see women on crutches and women on wheelchairs. That is the worst impact effect on mobility. And because these devices obviously are implanted in the vagina, that's associated with scar tissue, excessive fibrosis, and damage to the vagina that is permanent and cannot be reversed in most women, it certainly caused difficulty with sexual intercourse. Some women developed erosion or exposure where the device that is supposed to be under the skin of the vagina, it erodes through the skin and becomes exposed inside the vaginal canal. And clearly that causes pain, not only in the woman, but her husband also gets pain. Some women describe this as if having teeth within the vagina, and we heard that expression from some women before. Because of the chronic pain and difficulty in mobility, lots of women have lost their income, lost their livelihood, they were unable to work anymore. And because of loss of trust in the medical profession, some women were seeking private treatment. There are stories where women had to sell their houses or remortgage the houses so they can generate that income. There are lots of very bad and sad stories, actually. It did negatively affect relationships, clearly because of loss of intimacy. And there are other complications in terms of worsening incontinence, worsening prolapse, and also complications like ongoing vaginal discharge that is very resistant to treatment. In extreme cases, the mesh device itself can erode into the vagina or into the bowel. In some cases, that can cause severe sepsis or infection. And there has been cases, at least two I'm aware of, where there were overwhelming sepsis that was fatal. It was a Scottish woman, actually, who was reported by the BBC to be the first woman who has mesh on her death certificate.
So you mentioned it was one of the most popular procedures at one point. At last count, how many people were affected by this?
That is a very good question, and I don't think anyone will be able to tell you that. One of the reasons is coding. Procedures were introduced quickly before coding. We don't know exactly the number of mesh devices implanted. And you also could imagine that the development of complications, every complication or every condition should have also a code to it. But also the coding system has sort of fell behind. So the complications came quickly before the coding. So it's difficult. However, there has been some robust evidence and systematic reviews in the literature that suggest that complication rate ranges between 10 to 15%. But that encompasses all types of complications, which means the majority of women who receive these devices are okay. and will probably be okay and will not develop any complications at all. So if a woman's listening to us just now and she said, oh my gosh, I did have that one, and she heard all about all these problems in the news, etc., and in the media, the most likely scenario, which is certainly more than 50%, is that there will be no complications. Be vigilant. If there are any symptoms down below, it's always good to have it checked early, because something that we did not know 15 years ago is that complications that are mesh-related can reveal themselves for the first time several years down the line after being quiescent or not causing any problems for several years.
Initially, when women started to say, I think it's mesh, I didn't have any problems before this procedure, something is up, how quickly was it taken seriously and who was it taken seriously by?
There is a large number of women who actually did not know that they had a mesh device. Exactly.
This is not a video podcast, but my eyes just went big, like, what?
Exactly. I can see that. I can see that in your eyes. Yes, that is true. So we surgeons, we thought that, you know, it became a very standard treatment. It's very easy. We thought that there is very, very little complications. So not all women were told, we are going to put plastic mesh in. And one of the reasons behind this is the terminology. So there was maybe some sort of euphemism into this in renaming the word mesh to tape. So it's only a tape. And some women perhaps may have understood that it's something like a coil, like a contraceptive device. It's just a tape. Obviously, the difference between this, that coil can be removed easily in the vast majority of women, but a tape is very difficult to remove because it just embeds itself into the tissues. And any attempt to removing it requires some sort of extensive surgery. Some women did not know that they had mesh, but even those who did know that they have a mesh device, a large number of them are coming back and saying, no one told us actually that this mesh can cause this and that. So even if they knew that there was a mesh device implanted, they did not link it initially. So they would go and seek treatment for somewhere else. And perhaps they would go to a gynecologist who does not use these meshes and does not know about these meshes and would start investigating another problem. So some women were told, oh, your problem is just because of the menopause, or maybe you have endometriosis. Do you know what? You need a hysterectomy. So some women have received these procedures when actually the problem, the underlying problem, was the mesh device. There are also another point in here is that some women went back to their original surgeon who put the mesh in the first place, subconsciously. Now, because if this surgeon is not aware the mesh can cause something that severe, or maybe this surgeon did not see this severe complication in their own patients, they heard about it elsewhere, they know the risk is reported in the literature, but I mean, we surgeons are humans as well. Sometimes you think, oh gosh, that can never happen to me, right? I'm a good surgeon. I've received good training in this. I've implanted the medical device according to the manufacturer's instructions. Why is this happening? It can't be me. And I think that is one of the issues there, in terms of some surgeons felt that if a patient develops complication, it's because of me, because of the surgeon. Well, we've realized later on that it's actually the medical device. So even in the best of hands, if you get the perfect patient who would be highly indicated for this device, or this device would be most suitable for her, you get the most skilled surgeon and you get the best manufacturer, not just a manufacturer that wants to manufacture a me too device or a lookalike of the original one. If you get the best one, you still get that risk of complication that I was quoting you earlier on. 3 years ago, there was a wonderful UK trial that showed, in the best of hands, very well-trained surgeons, best devices, highly selected group of women, you still get 14% risk of chronic pain, which is fascinating.
So you've talked about the best, but you've also talked about some surgeons, consultants, not fully disclosing the nature of the device and the complication. So in that instance, is that because the surgeon didn't know? Why would they not reveal that or disclose that and discuss the true name of the device and the complications associated with the device?
I don't think it's malicious. It's not intentional. The scientific literature did report the complications. The leaflets at the time and the recommendation from the health watchdog and the device watchdog did report the complications at the time. There were very early review articles from the Royal College that did report that this complicated nerve injury can happen. I've got to mention that chronic pain can be due to nerve injury, direct nerve injury, or indirect nerve injury a few years down the line. So there may be a false perception of the risk, or perhaps minimizing the severity of that risks, or something like, oh, it cannot happen to me. I'm a very clever surgeon. I've done hundreds of these procedures. Why is this woman coming back with chronic pain like this? So there was a bit of denial on behalf of some surgeons as well. Also, one of the main issues is that before the mesh was introduced, using native tissue to repair the childbirth damage requires higher skill. So you only get surgeons who are highly skilled, who have been very well trained in this, to perform the procedures right, to do the patient selection first, to make sure that women will get the surgery only if they need it, and to tailor the surgery to the patient. So that's why you get a certain number of women receiving this procedure every year. After the introduction of mesh, because it is less invasive, it takes only 15 to 20 minutes to do rather than an hour to proper repair the damage using own tissues. What happened is that a large number of surgeons who perhaps did not do any of these continence procedures before, did not select women, did not assess women carefully for this probe before, a large number of them came on board and started using this procedure for the first time as the first continence procedure they have ever done. Yes, they went into the training, and yes, they were very clever in implanting it. But we know that this is not a technician thing. There's patient selection. There is offering the non-surgical treatment first. There is offering the alternatives, including the native tissue surgery. But quite a number of the surgeons, because they did not used to do this operation, the difficult operation before, it was not part of their repertoire, not part of their surgical armamentarium. The ease of this procedure, it was very easy to implant for the surgeon, very quick. So the NHS is winning because the patient does not have to stay overnight, goes home on the same day. And the patient also, oh, wow, I can go back to work in a couple of weeks' time or 3 weeks' time. Oh, yeah. So I don't have to be there. Oh, wonderful. So everyone was winning here. So
they thought.
Exactly. So we found out that over just the very first few years after introducing the mesh in the UK, the number of women receiving continence surgery shoot up. It went to double the number after a few years of introduction. That cannot be due to aging population, cannot be due to other demographics or anything. It can only be due to that more surgeons are coming over and more women are receiving this. They would not have received the continence surgery, the big invasive continence surgery before the mesh was introduced anyway. There are factors in the patient, factors in the device, obviously, and factors in the surgeon.
The Business of Healthcare podcast is brought to you proudly in partnership with 10,000 Donors and their Gob for Good campaign. Gob for Good is all about getting as many people as possible to join the stem cell registry. Only 3% of the UK are registered to be stem cell donors, and only 0.4% of the global population. If you or a loved one have the devastating news that you have been diagnosed with a blood cancer, the chances of you finding your blood stem cell match is significantly reduced if you have a minority ethnic heritage. It is really, really simple. All you need to do is click into the show notes or visit the Gob for Good website at gobforgood.com and get yourself signed up to the registry. You could one day receive that life-saving call, or one day you may need that life-saving call. Now, let's jump back into this week's episode.
What is an acceptable level of risk? So where you mentioned, I think it was between 10 and 15% of the people developed complications. Is that acceptable? Is that like normal?
I think you're hitting the nail on the head here, right? We've debated this for several years, been debating this, right? I'm aware that some surgeon would say, well, what is a material risk? A material risk is something that more than 1%. If it's less than 1%, then do you actually need to tell your patients about it? Well, all the evidence at the time saying 1% or more, that means it's common. But is this what women understand with the risk of 1%? If I say to you, Tara, 1% risk of developing serious problem if you have a hernia mesh, would you take it? You probably would.
1%, right? Yeah, I'd be 1%. Like, yeah.
You probably would, right? Okay.
Well, not now, but yeah.
Right. There are other women who would say, all right, well, the numbers don't matter. What is the risk? What can happen to it? I was talking to a patient the other day and I said to her, well, the risk of this problem is that, of course, not mesh because we stopped using that. I said to her, it's 10% risk. Oh, 10%, that's not bad then, is it? Said, no, it's not. So do the numbers matter that much? I don't think they do, but
they do. If it's the most common procedure, because my understanding, this was on the scale of the Flamidify scandal, there's thousands and thousands, thousands of women. You listed all of the complications. So I suppose it's not a question that you can answer, but the question is, what is an acceptable level? You know, 10% of women and their lives, their marriages, their livelihoods, their sex life, how they see themselves. It's like, how valuable is a life?
Absolutely. Totally agree. I think the acceptable level of risk needs to be in comparison to the available alternatives, right? So if there is 5% risk associated with mesh, but the alternative to it is 4%, 6%, then perhaps that goes into context. The definition of safety is freedom from unacceptable risk. So if I come to a patient and I say, look, there is a risk of chronic pain with this condition and it's 1%. Some woman will be acceptable to her. Another woman will not be acceptable to her, right? So for example, a woman has been living for chronic pain for a while and she got it under control and she's happy with it for any other reason. Then coming to me and I'm saying to her, okay, I'm going to do this intervention for you and there is a risk of 1% chronic pain. This woman would not accept it. I said, no, I don't want that. But if I say there is 2 or 3% risk of chronic pain to a different woman, she would accept it. On balance, depending on her condition at the moment and depending on the other alternatives as well, right? But let's remember, incontinence and prolapse are not life-threatening. They are quality of life thing, right? And I was listening to the BBC this morning, listening to the patient stories, exactly the same stories as I hear in my gynecology clinic, urogynecology clinic every day. I've got this and I thought it's the menopause. Oh, just because I have childbirth. It's just women's issues, right? So the average time between developing the problem and presenting to a healthcare professional with it to seek medical treatment, sometimes it takes 1.5 years, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes more. So it's a quality of life thing. It's not life-threatening. So if someone wants to sort it out and they tried the non-surgical treatment, the conservative treatment, and it hasn't worked and they want surgery for it, right? If I say to them, it's 1% risk of chronic pain. What? I don't have chronic pain just now. I've been living this with this 2 or 3 years. That becomes a material risk, even though it's just 1%. So lots of factors come into it. The patient perception, the severity of the current condition, what are the other alternatives? Because there are other alternatives that are not associated with chronic pain at all.
But can I ask, is the terminology material risk, is that something you learn in medical school, or is that something you now understand because of the legal implications of this scandal?
That's a great question. So we understand risk in a way. Risk is very subjective. So medics, we understand risk that we must communicate any risk that is significant. Lawyers like the term material. Until 2015, when the Montgomery ruling has completely changed the world of consent in the UK. So communicating risk in here, I should be communicating the risk, not the one that only me believe it is significant or material, but only if a reasonable person believes it is material or significant. And if this particular patient believes its material significance. The Supreme Court, it was a Supreme Court ruling actually, in Montgomery in 2015, coined the phrase, whether a reasonable person or a reasonable patient or a reasonable doctor would attach significance to that sort of risk, right? There's a risk of 1 in 1,000,000 of losing an eye, right? That's a very, very remote risk. I wouldn't attach significance to it if I want to have an eye operation. But someone who's living with only one eye would attach significance to that risk, even if it's 1 in 1,000,000. That is why it is important that I consider the risk and I communicate the risk, not just the one I believe is important or material or significant, but the risk that I believe the patient in front of me would consider material significant.
So I feel like we're running out of time. So many questions. Okay. What was your role in all of this? Why are we here?
I've been involved with this mesh issue for quite a long time. I started working as an independent consultant. So I work in England. Most of my training, I had original training back in Cairo in one of the busiest maternity hospital, obstetrics and gynecology hospitals in Cairo. And then I moved to the UK in about 2002, completed the training, specialized in urogynecology in treating this condition, and moved to Scotland in 2009. Just 3 years after that, the mesh complications started to appear. Thanks to the campaigners in Scotland, the Scottish mesh survivors, they have taken it to really high level in terms of raising the awareness. They petitioned Parliament, and I was asked by the Scottish government to join four of my colleagues, clinicians, to join a working group with the patients, with government officials, the representative from the Royal College, representative from the device watchdog, the MHRA, the regulatory authority. And we all sit down and decide what needs to be done. One of the very first thing that became very obvious is that the consent was not standardized. Women were being told different things in different hospitals. So in a country that size of Scotland, right, which is not massive, you still get significant variation, despite there being a individual information leaflet in every hospital, but they were saying different things. And it depends on the depth of knowledge of those who wrote the leaflet. If someone looked properly at the scientific evidence at the time, the leaflet would have probably a lot more detailed. I was involved in the research into these devices at the moment, and I suppose that is probably one of the reasons I was asked by the government official to join four of my colleagues in doing this, who were also, most of them were doing research into these devices at the time. We knew that there should be restrictions. However, as things happened, the health minister at the time decided to suspend all procedures until an independent review into the safety of these devices has concluded. Before the suspension, I think that just was a few weeks before the suspension, we were asked to sign the petition of the patients. So we clinicians, the clinicians member of the group, and we sit on the round table with representative of the campaigners, the women who were mesh injured, and telling their story and saying to them, look, once we went out and we went on social media, etc., we found lots of women like us. It's something like the post office scandal that we've been hearing about.
Right?
Something like that. And so we just became acutely aware of these mesh complications. And then the patient representative asked us to sign their online petition to Parliament. I did sign the petition because I agreed with most of the points. Maybe I just partially agreed with the suspension. I thought, okay, let's suspend the most risky devices and let's keep the ones that we believe the benefit outweigh the risk at the moment. But I still signed the petition in there. After the suspension of the complete suspension of mesh, most of my colleagues continued offering it. I stopped completely until we do the independent review and find out what is the safety about these devices, etc., etc. After this, we published the interim report in 2015, and we were supposed to publish the final report in 2016. It became very obvious that there is serious split in the clinicians group about perception of safety. What are you talking about? What is acceptable? What is not acceptable? It's a huge responsibility put on our shoulders. What is the restrictions that we're going to put in place? Which procedure we're going to allow? Which procedure we did not allow? I felt that it's the recommendations as we were asked to agree to were not safe enough. We discussed this at length with colleagues and clinicians, government officials, etc., but unfortunately we could not reach an agreement. So the chair has resigned, and then 3 months later, I resigned from the group. The independent report came out later on. Well, I'm calling it independent. I should be calling it a government report rather than an independent report, because I did not believe there was 100% independence in here. Came out recommending that we reinstate the mesh procedures, so we bring them back. And that was early 2017. That was the reason why I resigned before the publication of the report. Then I was asked to go to Parliament and ask and answer questions from members of Parliament in Scotland.
You know, that's on YouTube.
Yeah, it was.
I watched it. Like, how nerve-wracking. Well, I'm making the assumption. Was it nerve-wracking or was it just like a normal day?
It was absolutely nerve-wracking. It was difficult. I think what was about it is there was a huge responsibility. Now, here you are. You're one of the clinicians who resigned from a government group where the whole media was looking at it at the time, and you are coming to talk to us And I never knew what question they were going to be asked me. However, I must say that after the first 10 minutes or so, after I said my statement and after I answered the first one or two questions, I just felt, you know, comfortable. I was just giving them the information that I have. And I did not regret any minute of it. However, okay, let me just tell you something important. Just 2 months before this appearance in Parliament, I was in a Federal Court of Australia in Sydney, giving evidence and being cross-examined by the top lawyers of the main manufacturer of mesh. And that cross-examination lasted for 1.5 days. So I think in comparison, you know, and that was a class action that involved, I think, 1,400 women. And the judge ruled that the mesh devices were defective and the women needs to be compensated by the manufacturer. So going back to the Scottish Parliament, I think my resignation and the evidence I given in Parliament at the time, I'm really glad that it was helpful in preventing more women in Scotland developing these complications.
The role of the manufacturer, you did the cross-examination in Australia. What happened in the UK or what happened in Scotland? Do you know what happened in Scotland? What happened in the UK when it comes to the role of the manufacturer?
So the regulation of medical devices and medicine is a devolved matter to the UK government. So Scotland does not have its own regulatory system, if you see what I mean. So the medicine and healthcare products regulatory authority, the device watchdog, is a UK-wide one. So the manufacturer will manufacture the device and market it. When the mesh devices for incontinence were introduced in the late 90s, the trial started in the late 90s to check the safety of and success of these devices. Once, I think even before the trial was successful or completed, the manufacturers wanted to market and to reap the benefit of this massive advance in healthcare. And they did this by expanding, by advertising these mesh devices to surgeons, as I was saying earlier, that who never done this type of continence surgery before, do not know how to properly assess a patient, right? Because they wanted to sell. Actually, the Federal Court in Australia looked at aggressive marketing and it was found that some manufacturers were aggressively marketing these devices to generalist surgeons who did not perform these procedures, any continence procedures before. So that is one thing. The other thing is the design of the device itself. At the design stages, it was known that these devices can cause some complications. The court has found that the manufacturer knew that these adverse events can happen, these complications can happen, and these complications are linked to the design of the device. And these risks were not warned against in the manufacturer's information leaflet that is directed to the patient. And it was not warned against in the instructions for use directed to the surgeon. So if you design a product and you fail to communicate the risks that it is associated with, then that is, it's my understanding, that it is part of a defective design or part of your liability as a manufacturer.
Was any case brought against them? Who is accountable in the end?
Unfortunately, it's a team sport. Safety, medical device safety, is a responsibility of the manufacturer, actually the notifying body, which this is the first port of call. For example, you, Tara, you've designed a medical device, you think it's wonderful, right? Where do you go? You cannot go to the device watchdog straight away. You need to go to something called a notified body. You need to notify this body that I've done this device and I think it's good, and here is the paperwork behind it. And then the notified body will communicate with the MHRA, and this is the process where you go. Clearly, medicines go through a very rigorous regulation process, but medical device don't. If you compare medicine and medical device, the tablet you're taking has gone through intensive regulation, but the medical device is less robust. And I think the best example of this is Professor Carl Hennigan in Oxford has done something really interesting a few years ago, actually, and it was on, in TV in the Netherlands. is that he got, do you know this fruit net, the tangerines net, the orange thing,
No.
the net, right? You know this,
Oh,
the we,
yeah. No, yeah.
that's that the orange net that we carry the fruits in it and things. So
Yeah.
he went to the supermarket and he cut part a bit of this, right? And he wrote an application to the notified body, say, I've invented a mesh device. And he
Okay.
was very close to getting the approval, if he hasn't actually got it. So that shows you that there wasn't really a very robust. Clearly, the regulation is better now, and there is an EU directive in reclassifying the mesh devices into a higher category that requires further testing. Clearly, the change in the directives will take some time until it relates to the it translates to something practical on the ground. So it is the responsibility of the manufacturer to design properly, to warn against the possible or the known adverse events, and to separate the marketing team from the design team and the team that writes the information leaflet. They need to be completely separated. The responsibility clearly of the regulator here, so the device regulator all through the mesh crisis. Up until the suspension in the UK in July 2018, the device watchdog kept saying the benefit outweigh the risk. The benefit outweigh the risk. The benefit outweigh the risk. In each report published since 2012 until 2018, in every written report, in every media announcement, in every interview, even when they were sitting around the table discussing these, both in Scotland and also part of the NHS England roundtable discussion about these devices. The MHRA representative will always say, genre mesh devices, benefit outweigh the risk. Even for prolapse, when we knew, clinicians, researchers knew that actually there is no benefit to it compared to other native tissue surgery, you don't get benefit. So if the benefit is zero, then the benefit risk ratio is zero too, right? Because the benefit is a numerator and the risk is the denominator, right? So if you get zero benefit, then probably the benefit risk is zero. So the benefit cannot outweigh the risk.
This podcast is called The Business of Healthcare. I think I've been geeking out on this. This is not in any order, but for my medical students, for people that work in a university, people in health tech, or leaders and managers in the NHS, this is like when I did my MBA, this would have been like an MBA case study. And they'd have been like, right, organize yourself into group. You're the hospital, you're the clinical team, you're the patient group, you're the medical regulator, you're the solicitor, you're the marketing department, you are the designer. And it's like what I've highlighted is we've got breakdown in clinical governance. We've got a breakdown in corporate governance. There is the risk and how that is communicated and what is acceptable, which is dependent on the patient, the role of the manufacturer, the marketing of the device. We haven't covered it. We won't have time, but it's like the role of business. I think when we first spoke, it's like, what is driving this? Is it a business opportunity, a cost effective? You can look at it from either way. It is a business opportunity for the manufacturer and its cost effectiveness for the NHS. We've talked about consent and full disclosure. We've talked about research and investigations, the process and how long it takes. So it started in 2017, kind of ended in 2018, but there will be women that are still experiencing issues. We talked about training. Talk about health and safety, you talked about the notified body, you talked about the amount of risk and the responsibility from a consultant or a doctor or a professional. And that one day you've got these bright hopes of being a doctor, and then the next minute you're being cross-examined. Not the next minute, but do you know what I mean? Like the
Yes.
leadership skills, the communication, it's a personal toll on lots of people in this process. Obviously, we've got patients and the power of social media and the power of when communities come together. You talked about legislation and kind of all of the stakeholders involved in that policy, parliamentary reviews, independent question mark or government reviews. And then I think it's your ethics and your values. It got to a point where you thought, I don't agree with this. You've invested a lot of time and then you've gone, do you know what? I don't believe in the system. So
That's right.
my final question to you is, what have you learned about yourself throughout all of this?
I've learned a lot through this. The most important lessons is to believe the patient in front of me. If a patient says there is something wrong, then there is something wrong. And I shouldn't believe the voice inside my head and say, oh, you are the best surgeon. You've done it. You're the best surgeon. She's the best patient. This is the best device. I shouldn't have listened to this. The second lesson is to interpret research myself and don't listen to key opinion leaders.
Ooh.
So I think we're in front of a case where I was interpreting the evidence myself and I'm coming to a conclusion. And then I hear an opinion leader in this, particularly when I was in the last years of my training, and I hear a very highly renowned key opinion leader in this subject saying something that is not quite right or is different from the research I've looked into, and realize later that most of the key opinion leaders actually were receiving payment from industry. And this is the declaration of interest that the British Medical Journal has talked a lot about and published a full article about. So the competing interests with industry and taking money from industry is a big thing, right? The mesh is only one part of it, but it's a massive thing. But I think listening to the patient and interpreting the evidence myself, these two lessons were so vivid when we were sitting in the round table. The patients were saying something, my colleagues who were key opinion leaders were saying something. My interpretation of the research was different, was in agreement with the patient. What I've learned is read the evidence yourself. Start with a question first before going and read the groundbreaking new research that's being published. Ask yourself a question first. What is it I'm interested to find from that study? Ask the question and then go into the study or to the research or whatever and try and find the answer to that question and see if the study actually answers it. We know that evidence-based medicine is the what's published in the research, what is the clinician interpretation. But the third pillar, the third main pillar is the patient understanding of it, what matters to the patient. And I think combining the three will get us somewhere. I still do believe in evidence-based medicine using these three pillars. I think that this is what we wanted to do in the government group in Scotland, but unfortunately we're unable to do it. But time after this has proven that it could have been done.
I cannot thank you enough. I could burst. I feel so happy. Thank you so much. It's so interesting. I loved it.
I really hope that helps further raising awareness about this particular problem and also awareness about implanting a medical device in the future. So if anyone, God forbid, comes into a situation where you consider this, just balance the evidence and balance the benefit and risk and see if the benefit that you want to get actually outweigh the risk.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much. All the best.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what you hear, I would absolutely love it if you left us an iTunes rating and 5-star review. I know many of you give us a shout out on social media, which is lovely to see you guys listening to the podcast. So please come and find us on Twitter at THC Primary Care, on Instagram and on LinkedIn. Just look for Tara Humphrey. And if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, please do. You get to hear more insights, more confessions, some tips and tools and a roundup of our activity over the week. So click on join the newsletter in the show notes and I will see you in the next episode.